Medical Research Council. And the researchers gave healthcare workers two shots of the vaccine separated by about 6 to 9 months. And what they found was after that second shot, the vaccine protected against hospitalization with due to Omicron somewhere between 54 and 95%. So it's quite similar to what's been observed with two shots of the mRNA vaccine. Now, I should mention that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention prefers using the mRNA vaccines instead of the J&J for that second shot. But, you know, here's the big caveat here. Two shots of any of these vaccines do not protect people against infection with Omicron. So a large number of vaccinated people are getting infected.
Yeah, and I want you to explain more about that, if you would, Michaeleen. Why are a large number of people who are vaccinated getting infected with this variant?
Yeah, so this is the huge difference between Omicron and Delta. With Delta, breakthrough infections weren't super common, but with Omicron, they are very common. That's because Omicron has a bunch of mutations that help it get around the vaccine's protection against infection. Recent studies in the UK have found that with Omicron, there will be 5 times as many breakthrough infections as with Delta. And right now, Omicron is spreading rapidly in big cities and in the Northeast. And these are places with very high levels of vaccination. So many of these infections that we're seeing right now are breakthrough infections in vaccinated people. And breakthrough infections, even with Omicron, are not likely to be severe.
Okay, so tell me if I'm getting this right. Right now, the data showing low hospitalization rates makes it look like we're seeing a milder version of this virus. But you're saying that actually it's likely to do more with our growing immunity coming from vaccines that is protecting many people against more severe disease. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I was talking to Dr. Robi Bhattacharya about this. He's an infectious disease doctor at Massachusetts General Hospital. He says data suggests that in unvaccinated people, Omicron may be just as severe as variants circulating in the U.S., but it spreads much, much faster.
It's still going to find people who don't have immunity. And in fact, I think it's going to find them faster just because it spreads faster and it can spread through these vaccinated networks that used to slow things down, and they don't slow it down as much.
And so the U.S. could actually end up with way more hospitalizations than the early data suggests right now.
That's NPR's Michaeleen Duclef. Thank you for your reporting.
Thank you.
The Omicron variant is making the New Year's holiday really hard for millions of Americans. As infections surge around the country, celebrations are being canceled. Air travel is upended. College football games are being scrubbed. Even in Florida, a state that tried to go full steam ahead through much of the pandemic, the Miami Hurricanes had to pull out of a football game, and a production of The Nutcracker was canceled. NPR's Brian Mann joins us now to take stock of it all. Hey, Brian.
Hey, good morning, Sarah.
You've been talking with people about how they're navigating this New Year's Eve and holiday weekend amid this variant. How are they feeling?
You know, a lot of Americans are bummed, and I think even seriously bummed is a fair way to describe it. People told me they tried to get through Hanukkah and Christmas with good cheer and a kind of stiff upper lip. But a lot of that has turned to gritted teeth and impatience, and also in some cases, real sadness and loneliness. Here's Pam Mandel, a writer who lives in Seattle.
My cousin was supposed to arrive, but that is actually no longer happening. She called me from Indiana and said, my flight's been canceled. I'm driving back home to New Jersey.
Pam told me she lives alone. And when we spoke, she'd just gotten the news that she would be by herself again on New Year's Eve. And she admitted feeling kind of rattled.
Well, I have to tell you, I laughed because it was so weirdly predictable given how bad things have been.
Pam says she wanted to be a good sport about all this, but she was really looking forward to this New Year's Eve as a time to pivot. You know, the stakes are higher as people look for some kind of marker between this hard 2021 that we've all just gone through and what she hopes will be a better year. And so with this holiday upended, Pam says she's letting herself experience anger.
We're afraid to have feelings about what's happening right now, and that seems really unhealthy. We're navigating this incredibly difficult experience, and then everybody's sort of sitting at home quietly by themselves, and I feel often like I would like to scream about it.
One of the weird things about talking to people is that a lot of them feel lonely and isolated when they're actually sharing the same experience.
We're probably just going to be at home, suboptimal, but here we are.
That's Lala Tanmoy Das, who lives in New York City with his husband, Eric. They both work in healthcare and told me they're incredibly burned out. So they took some time off this year and made plans for a really fun New Year's Eve, a big party in Philadelphia, and a wedding for the next day. Then this week, they tested positive for COVID.
It's sad. I mean, I think we wanted to be with our friends. We wanted to have a celebratory occasion for their wedding, but also for the new year. And yeah, so all of that is canceled. The couple also end up postponing their wedding because so many people have tested positive from their guest list.
And I found it's not just individuals who've had their New Year's Eve scrambled by this virus. It's whole communities. I was in a beautiful little mountain village in upstate New York this week, Saranac Lake, that holds a New Year's festival every year.
We have a couple hundred people that go. It's usually pretty crowded.
That's Susan Patterson, who's helped organize the New Year's celebration in this small town for the last 16 years. They had to cancel last year, and now they've canceled again. And she said the decision was painful for people. You know, winters are long here, and this New Year's Eve is usually a bright spot when people come together.
It is an important part, yes. And I'm sort of afraid after 2 years of not doing, we're going to kind of lose the momentum, the excitement.
Susan told me this was also an important thing for her. Organizing this townwide party is her way of connecting and celebrating. So I asked what she'll do now for New Year's Eve.
I don't know. Nothing.
And I heard from a lot of people like that, Sarah, musicians, people who operate concert venues and theaters. They've all had their big nights canceled.
Yeah, Brian, I think a lot of people will recognize that sort of accumulated sense of burnout and repeated disappointment. Is there any advice or guidance for people who are feeling this right now?
Yeah, you know, we talked to Magdalena Bachmeier. She's a neuroscientist and wellness coach. And she said this is an important time to reach out to other people, make connections. And she also said it's important to focus on treating yourself as well as possible right now without sort of worrying about the big picture.
I would invite people to really think about how do you construct the next 24 hours? How do you plan to make sure that you have some things you can look forward to and begin to take that control back and really thinking about how you look after yourself.
And it's important, Sarah, to say this isn't affecting everyone the same. I spoke to young people who've had, you know, New Year's Eve big parties canceled, but they're still trying to get out, still trying to organize smaller house parties with friends.
And so what is the public health guidance for people of any age who've decided they do want to gather and celebrate despite the risk of Omicron?
You know, obviously the first step, as we've been hearing, is to be vaccinated and boosted, wear good masks. Also, people are advising a lot of communication with hosts and other guests. New York's Governor Kathy Hochul talked about this during one of her briefings this week.
Possibly stay outdoors. It's a little chilly, especially upstate New York, but it'll be worth it when you have a chance to be together with your loved ones and friends this time again next year. So talk to all your hosts and your friends and everybody. And if you're sniffling, if you're not feeling good, just stay home, watch the ball drop on television, get a nice glass of champagne, and know that you're doing the smart thing. So our New Year's resolution is we'll get through this winter surge together.
And as we've been hearing, Sarah, New York City has scaled back that ball drop celebration in Times Square this year. It will still happen with a smaller crowd and masks even outdoors. But even with these precautions, public health officials expect another surge of Omicron cases after these holiday gatherings.
NPR's Brian Mann. Thanks, Brian, and Happy New Year.
To you as well, Sarah.
This is NPR News.
It's 8:19 now, and this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening today. Coming up in 15 minutes, the supply chain backlog has ships backed up off the coast of Los Angeles. They're spewing exhaust that's affecting the air quality in Southern California and renewing environmental health concerns.
One of the benefits of having an IRA is that you can take your required minimum distribution in the form of a gift to Wisconsin Public Radio. The IRA charitable rollover is a convenient and tax-free way to support the news, information, and music you rely on each day. Talk with your financial advisor or visit wpr.org/support to learn more. Make a difference today. Thank you.
Support for WPR is provided by the Eduardo Neil Silva Young Artists Fund in memory of his dedication to young performers. Eduardo Neil Silva was a respected educator at the University of Wisconsin and dedicated listener to WPR.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the American Red Cross blood supply is at historically low levels. If more donors don't come forward to give blood, some patients may face delays in care. To learn how to donate, visit redcrossblood.org.
For the last few days of 2021, cloudy skies today with a chance of snow showers across the state, highs ranging from the mid-teens in the north to the mid-30s in the south. On Friday, continued cloudy. The north could get a few snow showers, highs ranging from the low teens in the north to the mid-30s in the south.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from MGM with Licorice Pizza, written and directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, about the navigation of first love, starring Alana Haim, Cooper Hoffman, Sean Penn, and Bradley Cooper, now in select theaters, everywhere Christmas. From Workday, an enterprise management cloud focused on providing organizations with a system to continuously plan for all what-if scenarios. Workday. The finance, HR, and planning system for a changing world. From Tire Rack. For more than 40 years, Tire Rack has remained committed to helping people find the right tires, wheels, and automotive accessories. A tire decision guide is at tirerack.com/TDG.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Sarah McCammon.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. The army of statues across the American South thinned out this year. These are monuments honoring leaders or soldiers of the Southern Rebellion of the 1860s. Most went up in later times as a public defense of racial segregation. The 21st century question is not really whether to remember history, but how. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
More than 50 tributes to the Confederacy were removed, relocated, or renamed in 2021, according to an ongoing tally from the Who's Heritage Project at the Southern Poverty Law Center.
They were monuments, they were schools, they were roadways. We saw a lot of schools change their names, which I think is quite significant.
Leisha Brooks is chief of staff at the SPLC.
Because no student should have to go to school in a place that's named after a former enslaver.
She points to Jacksonville, Florida, where citizens pushed to change the names of six public schools, including Robert E. Lee High School, named for the Confederate general. But Brooks says some 2,000 memorials remain, mostly in the South.
They're continuous symbols of white supremacy.
The Who's Heritage Project started keeping count after the 2015 massacre at Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. At the time, images of the man who killed nine worshipers posing with a Confederate flag prompted South Carolina and Alabama to remove the flag from state capitol grounds. Walmart and other retailers quit selling Confederate merchandise. Brooks says 2 years later, there was another spike in doing away with Confederate symbols after the deadly white nationalist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. And then last year, when the memorials became a flashpoint after the police killing of George Floyd.
It felt to me like people kind of put together all the pieces and were able to identify that as being foundational to white supremacy. It's like people understood it and it was a tangible thing they could point to as being anti-Black racism.
Early this year, Mississippi began flying a new state flag, featuring a magnolia blossom instead of the Confederate battle emblem. In Washington, D.C., the House of Representatives voted to remove all Confederate statues from public display at the U.S. Capitol. And Virginia, the state with the most Confederate monuments, led the way in taking them down. Crowds cheered as a giant statue of Robert E. Lee on his horse was dismantled in Richmond in late September. And then in Montgomery, Alabama, a city known as both the cradle of the Confederacy and the birthplace of the civil rights movement, local leaders are taking stock of street names. Mayor Stephen Reed.
We renamed Jefferson Davis Avenue, or Jeff Davis Avenue, as it was put on our street signs, after civil rights attorney Fred D. Gray.
Jefferson Davis was the first president of the Confederacy. Fred Gray's clients included Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks during the Montgomery bus boycott. Gray, now 91 years old, grew up in Montgomery in a house on Jeff Davis Avenue. Reed, the city's first black mayor, says the change is about balancing the pain and the progress of the nation.
How is it that those who have been heroic in so many cases around this country are often forgotten, but those who have been at the helm of some of the most sinful moments in our nation's history have been illuminated?
But the city's action comes with a price. Alabama Attorney General Steve Marshall has put Montgomery on notice that it must pay a $25,000 fine for violating the Alabama Memorial Preservation Act or face a lawsuit. Here's Marshall.
I think it's a very slippery slope when you allow for elected officials to pick and choose the laws that they believe they should follow and the ones that they shouldn't.
Alabama was one of several states that passed monument protection laws as a backlash in the racial reckoning after Charlottesville. The argument was the laws would prevent attempts to erase history. Alabama Governor Kay Ivey used the issue in her reelection campaign at the time.
When special interests wanted to tear down our historical monuments, I said no and signed a law to protect them.
Since, Marshall has imposed fines on several local governments for removing or relocating Confederate statues, including Birmingham and Mobile.
As Attorney General, my job is to enforce the law as it is, and unless and until the legislature changes, we're going to continue to do that.
Virginia's legislature has since revoked its monument protection law, clearing the way for one of the more creative approaches to repurposing a divisive symbol. Charlottesville this summer took down the Robert E. Lee statue that had been the focal point for white nationalists. The city is not putting the giant bronze in a museum or on a battlefield, but has given it to the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center. Director Andrea Douglas says it will be transformed.
Take the Robert E. Lee statue, melt it down, form it into ingots that could be used as raw material for an art form.
The project will seek community input on what type of art the statue will be made into.
Can we create something that, you know, defines the community in the 21st century? What does Charlottesville want to be? We describe ourselves as a city that believes in equity, that believes in social justice. So what does that look like in a public space?
She says it will be about contending with all of Charlottesville's history, considering the founding of the nation, slavery, Jim Crow, and the modern-day trauma when people were killed and injured as a consequence of alt-right ideology in 2017.
This is really not about erasing history. It's about taking history and moving it forward.
Douglas hopes the art project in Charlottesville can serve as a roadmap for other communities to reimagine what belongs in the public square. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Millions tune into Dan Bongino's radio show, where the talk is of a Trump run in 2024, and the audience includes Trump supporters who turned out on January 6th.
The ideas that animated people at the Capitol on that day are alive and well on the airwaves, and that's not going away.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The right-wing media machine Bongino is building this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 here on WP.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
It's Morning Edition on WPR, and in news, a new proposal from Democratic state lawmakers would impose fines for sending unwanted sexual images by phone or email in Wisconsin. More coming up in our newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Two studies indicate Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccine shows promise against the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. One study is from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. The other is out of South Africa. New coronavirus infections in the U.S. have jumped to record levels over the past couple of weeks amid the spread of the Omicron variant. Johns Hopkins University says the country is now averaging 282,000 additional cases each day. Canada says it won't follow U.S. guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on how long people should isolate if they test positive but remain asymptomatic. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
The Public Health Agency of Canada says it's aware of the CDC's updated guidance on shortening the isolation period from 10 days to 5 days, but it has no immediate plans to follow that lead. Isolation rules and quarantines vary across Canada based on recommendations from local public health experts. Some health experts in Canada say shortening the isolation period is still dangerous. Meanwhile, there's been another jump in the number of new cases this week, with Quebec posting more than 13,000, Ontario more than 10,400, and Alberta recording more than 2,700 on Wednesday. And with test backlogs in many locations, the numbers have yet to reflect gatherings over the Christmas holiday. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. People who send unsolicited sexual images by text or email in Wisconsin could face a fine of up to $500 under a new proposal from Democratic state lawmakers. Laurel White reports.
Under the plan, someone at least 18 years old who sends a graphic, unsolicited text could face a fine of up to $250 for the first offense and up to $500 for the second offense. Democratic State Senator Melissa Agard of Madison is one of the bill's sponsors. She says the proposal is aimed at holding predators accountable.
It's clearly predatory and disturbing behavior, and we want to make sure that folks have the understanding that this is not okay.
Bumble, an online dating app, is pushing the proposal. The company says a 2018 survey found one-third of its users reported receiving an unsolicited sexual image at some point. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Great Lakes ports are reporting a rebound in cargo shipments this year after the region's largest port witnessed historic lows during the coronavirus pandemic in 2020. The port of Duluth Superior handled about 29 million tons of cargo through the end of November, marking a 30% increase from the same time last year. The port of Green Bay also reported cargo shipments were up 9% through November, handling nearly 1.8 million tons. The port's director, Dean Hain, says manufacturing and new construction have spurred demand for products moving through the port.
And the port tends to be like a leading indicator, so as we're ending the year strong, means the economy in our area should stay strong well into the spring.
Last year, the port moved around 1.9 million tons of cargo, down more than 15% from 2019. For the first time, low-income residents in Wisconsin may be able to receive federal financial assistance to pay their water bills as part of $18 million in federal COVID-19 relief. The state is making the money available through a new program that will run through next September. The program will work with landlords and water utilities to pay off any past due bills for customers. The state anticipates eligible households could receive up to $5,000. A family of four making less than $60,000 each year may qualify for assistance. You're listening to news from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Novo Nordisk, working to improve the lives of people with obesity through knowledge, science, and compassion. Because obesity is a matter of biology, not just willpower. More at truthaboutweight.com. And from Jones Day, an integrated partnership collaboratively providing legal services for more than a century. 43 offices, 5 continents, serving clients as one firm worldwide. Learn more at jonesday.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Sarah McCammon.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. It's said that many people rarely talk by phone anymore. People text or email or DM or whatever, but that apparently does not apply to the presidents of the United States and Russia. President Biden speaks by phone with Vladimir Putin today, their second talk this month. NPR's Charles Maines is covering this story, and I want to pause to note Charles is a familiar voice on our air. He has been for a while, but he is now formally NPR's Moscow correspondent. So, Charles, welcome aboard officially.
Wow. Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it. It's an honor and a privilege.
It's good to have your insights. And what do you know about this call?
Well, you know, the White House announced the call only yesterday, saying Putin had requested to speak with Biden. The Kremlin spokesman here just confirmed that Putin thought the conversation was necessary and important to have. They also confirmed the call will take place quite late. It's at 3:30 in the afternoon in Washington, but that's 11:30 p.m. here. The White House said they expected the two leaders would discuss a range of issues that includes upcoming diplomatic engagements. I think that's another way of saying they want to talk about efforts to defuse the situation around Ukraine and this buildup of Russian forces there that has the U.S. fearing of an invasion and warning Russia of massive sanctions should it take military action. Now, if you're looking for hints as to how that'll go, Putin just posted a New Year's message to the Kremlin website saying he was convinced that effective dialogue with Biden was possible.
Is it better understood what Russia is aiming at when it puts troops on the border with Ukraine?
Yeah, well, fundamentally, this is about Russia trying to essentially block Ukraine's desire to move towards the West. To thwart that, Russia launched a proxy war in East Ukraine in 2014. This is where Russian-backed separatists have this simmering war with the government in Kyiv. But this latest Russian buildup seems to be a way for Moscow to force a conversation with the U.S. about something else, which is NATO's presence along Russia's borders. You know, Putin aired these concerns, what he's called his red lines, in a video conference call with Biden earlier this month. He spelled them out again at this annual press conference he gave last week. Let's listen in just a bit.
В этой связи мы ясно и четко дали понять, что...
So here Putin says that any further movement by NATO towards the east is completely unacceptable to Russia, and he argues the U.S. wouldn't tolerate it if the Kremlin was placing its military hardware near America's borders. Now, the Kremlin says it wants security guarantees from the U.S., and it's spelled out conditions. It wants no NATO membership for Ukraine and another former Soviet republic, Georgia. It says no military presence by NATO or weapon systems along countries bordering Russia, and it wants NATO to pull back its military deployments from Central Eastern Europe, places like Poland and the Baltic states. So at the core, what Putin wants is to turn the clock back on NATO's expansion after the end of the Cold War, and he's using the threat of an invasion of Ukraine to try and get it.
How does all of this look to the other NATO allies, by which I mean Western European powers that are allied with the United States but a lot nearer Russia?
Well, certainly the Eastern Europeans are not happy about this. A lot of them look to NATO as a way to guarantee their security from Moscow's influence. Of course, a lot of them were former communist governments taken over by the Kremlin after World War II. But I think, you know, in terms of what the Russian demands are, you know, is the question here, is it a bargaining chip? Are they trying to, kind of create a maximalist stance and see what they can get? Or is it an excuse to justify Kremlin military actions when and if diplomacy fails?
NPR's Charles Maines is in Moscow. Thanks.
Thank you.
There is still a backlog of ships waiting off the coast of Los Angeles because of supply chain problems. Those vessels in the bay are making the region's poor air quality worse. And residents are worried about what that means for their health, as Macon Jamerson with KCRW reports.
At his neighborhood in West Long Beach, California, Ron Batiste is sitting at his kitchen table. And while he's talking, he has to pause fairly often.
Forgive me if it's hard for me to breathe.
The 72-year-old musician's never been diagnosed with a lung condition, but he says this shortness of breath happens sometimes. Part of the problem, he thinks, is his neighborhood's air quality, which has been terrible for decades. Batiste points to the grime that collects daily around the sliding glass door and the AC vent, despite running an air purifier.
It's not just dust. It's like the oil.
Within 2 miles of his home is a rail yard, truck yard, oil refinery, and the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, the single largest source of emissions in the region. And with the months-long backlog at these ports, California state air regulators are warning the pollution from the extra ships is like adding nearly 6 million passenger cars to the road each day. Mario Cordero heads the port of Long Beach. He says he's aware people find the increased emissions worrisome.
The number of container ships at anchor off the coast should be zero. In the meantime, The best way to reduce the emissions is to reduce the number of ships at anchor.
To do that requires clearing out the backlog, which the ports say should be sometime before the end of 2022. In the meantime, the ports have slowed down ship arrivals and are requiring them to anchor further offshore. The long-term solution is battery-powered ships, which Cordero says is not a short-term prospect.
You know, you're looking now that maybe by 2050 or 2040, you're going to have some real substantive steps to move towards zero-emission vessels or cleaner fuels.
According to a study published in the journal Nature, these portside neighborhoods have over 1,000 premature deaths associated with ship pollution each year.
There's very clear data about living in the areas where that pollution is higher.
Dr. Elisa Nicholas is a pediatrician and the CEO of several local health centers near the ports. She'd like the rest of the country to understand the health costs of imported cheaper goods in these communities.
They are affected by the goods movement that many people are benefiting from.
She points to higher than average rates of childhood cancer, asthma, and asthma-related emergency room visits. These communities are also lower income, underinsured, and majority Black and brown.
And so really, we need to realize that this is a health equity issue, and it's an environmental justice issue, too.
Long Beach's Hilltop Park rises above the coast and offers a panoramic view of the ports. The sun is starting to set, a dozen ships are lined up heading into port, and a wind gusts toward shore, blowing what looks like smog.
See the yellowness? The yellowness?
Daryl Golden has lived in the area for 50 years. He's a retired transit worker and is frustrated by how little has changed with this decades-long environmental problem.
We should not be bearing the brunt of the trade industry on our backs. Because that's what it boils down to at the end of the day.
And the longer it takes for the industry to clean up, says Golden, the longer his community will continue to see preventable deaths. For NPR News, I'm Megan Jamerson in Long Beach.
Later on All Things Considered, during a visit to Los Angeles in October, the U.S. Secretary of Veterans Affairs committed to housing hundreds of homeless military veterans. So where does that promise currently stand? Listen to that story by asking your smart speaker to play your member station by name. This is NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up in 9 minutes, Steve Inskeep speaks with BBC correspondent Andrew Harding about his South African true crime literary thriller. It's called These Are Not Gentle People.
PBS Wisconsin Education and the Wisconsin School Music Association have partnered with music educators to create ReSound, Songs of Wisconsin, a free collection of classroom media resources featuring contemporary Wisconsin musicians. The collection is designed to help general music educators and learners explore the connections between music, culture, identity, and emotion. Access lesson plans and more. Visit pbswisconsineducation.org.
Support for WPR comes from All of Us Wisconsin, dedicated to helping speed up health research breakthroughs by asking 1 million people to share health information. Details at joinallofus.org/WPR.
The Gateway Radio Reading Service is for visually impaired listeners who would like to have newspapers and books read to them. In the Kenosha Racine area, easy-to-operate radios are available free of charge. Visit WGTD.org or call 564-3744.
Wisconsin Public Radio, and here's some of what's happening in the news today. An AP investigation reveals signs Myanmar's military is reverting to a strategy of massacres as a weapon of war. The massacres and scorched earth tactics, such as the razing of entire villages, represent the latest escalation in the military's violence against both civilians and the growing opposition. Since the military seized power in February, it has cracked down ever more brutally, abducting young men and boys, killing healthcare workers, and torturing prisoners. The U.S. government has approved California's overhaul of the nation's largest insurance program for low-income and disabled residents. The decision, among other things, allows Medicaid money to be spent on housing-related services as the most populous state struggles with homelessness and a lack of affordable housing. Starting with the new year Saturday, California will, among other things, expand what had been a limited whole-person care pilot program to eligible Medi-Cal members statewide. Stay with us. We'll have all the latest news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio just after 9 o'clock.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Klaviyo, working to help brands deliver personalized email and SMS campaigns that drive revenue and create genuine customer relationships. At klaviyo.com/NPR. From Autism Speaks. Autism Speaks is working to create a world where all people with autism can reach their full potential. Learn more at autismspeaks.org. And from the Lemelson Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Sarah McCammon. The most prominent pro-democracy media outlet still operating in Hong Kong is being forced to shut down. Stand News will end its operations after their offices were raided by police. Assets were frozen and journalists were arrested on sedition charges. It's all part of a crackdown that has intensified pressure on independent journalists throughout China. One of them is David Rennie. He's the Beijing bureau chief for The Economist, and he joins us now. Hello.
Hello.
One of the senior editors at Stand News called this the saddest year for Hong Kong's media. Can you put that into perspective for us?
It's not hyperbole. I mean, it has been an extremely bleak year, and it's ending on a particularly bad note. So you have seen the last few Chinese language pro-democracy newspapers and websites crushed with this dawn raid with 200 officers of Stand News. But early we saw this raucous tabloid, Apple News, being shut down. The tycoon who owns that has just been sentenced to another prison sentence for essentially a peaceful protest about Tiananmen Square. And it follows a whole bunch of moves by the central government, basically ordering the local government in Hong Kong to crack down in December. We saw essentially a fake sham election for the mini parliament. We saw a famous memorial to the Tiananmen Square massacre taken away in the dead of night from the main university in Hong Kong. And just generally a sense that the government in Beijing is feeling simultaneously very confident that the outside world is not going to push back very hard on all of this, and very paranoid that foreign forces might still try to use Hong Kong as a way to spread sort of trouble. And that mixture of confidence and paranoia, I think, is where we are at the end of December.
Yeah, I want to elaborate on that a little bit. That crackdown you mentioned on the press escalated in Hong Kong after dissent erupted over the enactment of a new national security law. But this really goes beyond Hong Kong, doesn't it?
That does. And you know, one of the extraordinary things about Hong Kong was that after the British gave it back to China in 97, for a very long time, you had free internet, you could go and interview people, you had people willing to criticize the government publicly, you had opposition politicians. It was not free, wasn't a full democracy, but it was by far the freest press environment in China, and pretty free for Asia. That really ended with the passage of the National Security Law, which was in the summer of 2020. That was China's response to the protests that your listeners will remember in 2019, anti-government protests. And since then, they've been gaining and gaining in confidence, willing to use this not just in Hong Kong, but even, you know, recently we saw some newspapers like the Wall Street Journal in the States published an editorial saying that the recent election in Hong Kong was a sham, and so maybe people might want to protest by casting a blank ballot or boycotting, just not voting. They got a letter from the Hong Kong government saying, under Hong Kong law, even saying that in the United States is illegal. You can't incite people not to vote in our patriots-only election. So they are now very willing to threaten foreign media, even big-name foreign media, which really says that the old argument that maybe foreign bankers and businessmen and finance would leave Hong Kong and that would hurt China and stay their hand, that argument just doesn't work anymore. China is done with being criticized by the West.
And briefly, David, in just 20 seconds or so, what's it like for you as a foreign journalist in China right now?
It's not great. We've had a lot of colleagues, particularly Americans, expelled. We're getting attacked a lot by the state media. But look, it is far, far worse for my Chinese colleagues. And I'm still remarkably privileged as a foreigner here with a British passport. I don't want to claim, that I'm the victim in all this. But China is cracking down because it feels the West shouldn't criticize it, and the West is weak and in decline, and so China can make its move.
David Rennie with The Economist in Beijing. This is NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's about 10 minutes before 9. We'll have classical music for you just after 9 o'clock with Stephanie Elkins. Celebrate the new year with WPR with the New Year's 2022 concert from Vienna. The annual concert will be performed by the Vienna Philharmonic, led this year by Daniel Barenboim. It's a festive program of waltzes, marches, and polkas, and you can hear it at 10 a.m. on Saturday, January 1st, 2022, on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Funeral Home. Honor a life well-lived with a gift of a service for burial or cremation with a professional, friendly, and compassionate staff. Serving the community for 90 years, Piasecki Funeral Home.
Is pleased to promote family-friendly fun. Find out more at wpr.org/events.
In sports, it's bowl game day for the Badgers football team. They play the Arizona State Sun Devils in the Las Vegas Bowl tonight at 9:30. The Badgers men's basketball team had an 89-85 win over Illinois State last night, and the Bucks play the Orlando Magic tonight at 6. Here's our weather forecast today. Cloudy skies with a chance of snow showers across the state, highs ranging from the mid-teens in the north to the mid-30s in the south.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Sarah McCammon.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. This next story takes us to a country that is deeply divided by race, even after it established a multiracial democracy. South Africa this week is mourning Archbishop Desmond Tutu. He was one of the leaders in the fight against apartheid decades ago. More than a quarter century after its end, the journalist Andrew Harding finds a country divided between black and white, rich and poor, urban and rural.
And indeed, when you move into the cities in South Africa, there are plenty of success stories. This is still a very, you know, a very vibrant country, and it's possible to get out of bed and travel around the country and feel very optimistic about it. But it's that land of deep, deep contrasts and deep inequalities.
Andrew Harding reports for the BBC across Africa. He also writes books, including one about a double murder almost 6 years ago in a rural area. It is called These Are Not Gentle People. In a South African region called the Free State, a few dozen white farmers own land. Black people work on them as laborers. One day, two black men who went by the names of Simon and Samuel showed up at the farm of a white man. He says they wanted to rob him. Others think they were demanding unpaid wages. What is certain is that the farmer pressed an alarm button summoning help from white neighbors.
About 50 white farmers, men and their sons, came charging across the fields in their pickup trucks, most of them armed, and they went and chased and hunted for these two black men, and they found them pretty quickly, and they arrested them, essentially, in the corner of a field, and then over the next hour or two proceeded very methodically and very brutally to beat those two men.
How severe was the beating?
The beating was severe enough to give both men multiple injuries all over their bodies, and particularly traumatic head injuries, so much so that both men lost consciousness. Both men were then thrown into the back of a police car, which then drove for a few hundred yards over a bumpy field and then onto a smooth road into town, where they were met by an ambulance, transported to a hospital, and then over the course of the next few hours were both pronounced dead.
So we have a kind of citizen's arrest that becomes an incident of beating and torture, ends with police having custody of the men, but they're dead at the end. What did authorities do with this set of facts?
Well, there was almost immediately an outcry, a sense that this surely was a racial murder, and that the white farmers involved should be arrested and put on trial as quickly as possible. But it was almost impossible for the police initially to make any headway because of a kind of wall of silence from the white farmers, who were led to believe that they could get away with this. The white farmers, most of whom were related, felt that it was in their best interests to say nothing. And it took months for the police to break that silence.
How did they do that finally?
Well, what happened in particular was that they managed to hack into the mobile phones of some of the younger farmers. They unlocked some WhatsApp messages and WhatsApp recordings in which some of these men, shortly after the attack, boasted and described what they'd been doing. And with those confessions, if you like, they went and arrested a number of the farmers and then essentially cut a deal with some of those farmers who'd basically been found guilty by virtue of what they'd left on those WhatsApp messages. And they ended up putting six men on trial, whereas about a dozen men in all had been proven and eventually admitted to taking part in the assaults.
That sounds like a pretty devastating case against those who were put on trial. And they were put on trial in a system that is led by a black majority government. What was the result?
This is where the story showed the institutional rot, because at every stage of the investigation and then in court, everything let Simon and Samuel down. And in the end, all of the farmers were acquitted of murder. They were found guilty of grievous bodily harm, of aggravated assault, but none of them was given any jail time whatsoever. The problem for the prosecution is that the forensic evidence, which was at the heart of the prosecution's case, was flawed. The original doctors who inspected Simon and Samuel's bodies made basic errors of fact and of medicine, and the whole chain of evidence was contaminated by a mixture of incompetence and managerial and institutional failures, which enabled the defence to pick apart the prosecution's case, and particularly the extraordinary matter of law which was brought up by the defence. Could it be that the two men died not from the beatings that rendered them unconscious, but from the fact that they spent a few minutes in the back of a police car being driven over a bumpy field? On that basis, the judge found the men not guilty of murder.
Meaning that incompetence left a lot of room for reasonable doubt.
Exactly.
Why did you call the book These Are Not Gentle People?
This was actually a phrase that emerged from one of the key characters, the wife of one of the accused, who used this phrase to me, these are not gentle people. She just said to me one day, talking about her neighbours, about her friends, about the people who had been involved that night in the brutal beating of Simon and Samuel. And it seemed to me a phrase, an ambiguous phrase, that could capture something of modern South Africa's struggles.
Do you think that if you spoke with some of the men who were involved in the attack that night and the killing that night, they would agree, we are not gentle people, we don't want to be, we can't be?
In fact, when they were in court arguing for a light sentence, they cited the book and the title and said it wasn't true, they were gentle people. And it struck me, as they argued that this was a community that had not been forced to confront what it had done and that was still, to some extent, in denial about what was wrong with society in South Africa, particularly in their community, and what hadn't changed.
Andrew Harding's latest book is called These Are Not Gentle People. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Sarah McCammon.
Thanks for tuning in for Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. You can hear the program weekdays from 5 to 9. News updates from NPR and WPR will be available every hour, and there's always more news on our website at wpr.org. It's a minute before 9. Classical music is on the way.
WPR is your source for essential news, compelling conversations, and refreshing music and entertainment. Thanks to the support of more than 50,000 members, including a growing number of monthly sustainers, your support makes WPR possible. Thank you.
Support comes from the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center, a trusted resource since 1999. The ADRC is a no-cost, one-stop shop for older people, adults with disabilities, and their families. Call 262-605-6646.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine.